One of We Are Movie Geeks' favorite actors of all time passed away last week. Christopher Lee, Sir Christopher Lee, I should say, passed away at age 93 in London, England. It's pretty sad. I would have to say that he was the last of the great classic horror stars, and really the only horror star. What horror stars are left?
That's it. I guess would he represent to you, to digress a little bit, in comic books we have a golden age and silver age, and you would say, I guess maybe the golden age of horror is maybe starts with Lon Chaney Sr. and ends with Lon Jr., and the silver age would start, I guess, with Peter Cushing,
Curse of Frankenstein,
and Christopher Lee. Mm-hmm.
True.
And he's the last of the silver age stars.
Yeah. I mean, you could say Barbara Steele, but she's sort of a cult star. If you're not part of her cult, you probably couldn't name more than a couple of films she was in. Where everybody loved Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing and Vincent Price.
Well, it is sad about him passing, but he, unlike, say, Bill Lugosi, who has kind of struggled at the end of his life, and maybe Lon Chaney Jr. was like that, Christopher Lee knew people loved him, that he was beloved, he was celebrated, and appreciated, and still working.
And went out on a high note. He was in the Peter Jackson Hobbit films. Look at all the directors he worked with, too. He worked with Scorsese in Hugo. He worked with Spielberg in 1941. Tim Burton loved Christopher Lee. He put him in several of his films.
Yeah.
But then go back, he was in Mario Bava, The Whip and the Body. He worked with Jess Franco, the notorious Spanish director, in several films. In fact, most of Jess Franco's films that were released in the United States starred Christopher Lee. What other actor has worked with all this directorial talent?
Yeah. Billy Wilder.
Yeah,
for
Billy.
Gosh
yeah.
sake,
mm-hmm. That's right.
Private Life of Sherlock Holmes as Mycroft, And the characters, it's just amazing that the same actor could play, of course, Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, The Mummy, Sherlock Holmes, and then do these classic villains like Roquefort from
Three Musketeers. My favorite.
Play a James Bond villain.
Yeah,
and one of the best Bond villains.
No, I think
sure.
so.
I mean, look at all the Bond franchise, the Lord of the Rings franchise, the Star Wars franchise. To be in those big.
Of course, the Hammer films.
Oh, and the Hammer films, definitely.
The Hammer was kind of built on his and Peter Cushing's shoulders,
I
think.
Well, he was in the first Hammer horror film, Curse of Frankenstein, in 1957, and he was in the last Hammer horror film, which was To the Devil a Daughter in 1976. His first role of note was in Hamlet, 1946. He played like a guard. He didn't have any roles. Peter Cushing was also in that. Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee co-starred 21 times in their career. And those movies are absolutely wonderful.
And, of course, when Hammer came back a few years ago with The Resident,
that's true.
He's in that with Oscar winner Hilary Swank.
That's right. Not a particularly good movie. But it was elevated by his presence. And a lot of movies were. I mean, you and I were all born at a time where we saw a lot of movies at the theater in the 70s. It was always so cool that Christopher Lee was pop up in these movies, like the James Bond movies, the Three Musketeers movies. You know, even cheesy movies like, Killer Force with Peter Fonda. And
The Serial with Martin Mull.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a biker.
Yeah, it was cool. In a couple of years ago, we did an article at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. We do Top 10 Tuesday a lot, and we'll find an actor, and we'll try to pick his 10 best movies. But we couldn't narrow it down. We couldn't narrow down Christopher Lee's 10 best movies because, you'd have to put 3 or 4 Dracula movies in there. Good grief.
Sure, yeah.
So we came up with the idea of doing Christopher Lee's 10 best characters, which I think was a good idea. We reposted a sort of a reformatted version of that article at We Are Movie Geeks last week to commemorate his passing. But let's talk about these roles. He did Frankenstein, of course. He only did Frankenstein once, and that was 1957's Curse of Frankenstein.
Along with Peter Cushing.
Dr. Frank.
I started their gothic horror series in Hammer.
We've discovered the source of life itself, and we've used it to restore a creature that was dead.
This is Frankenstein, who revolted against nature, who experimented with the devil and was forever cursed.
He's definitely a different take on the monster from Karloff and many of the Universal monsters. He's kind of a brutal creature in it, and he's pretty scary.
He looks kind of like more of a zombie than the flat-topped Frankenstein monster. I'm not surprised he didn't play the monster again. And then there were subsequent Hammer Frankenstein films. There were 7 of them, and with Peter Cushing. But none of them really had a monster per se. They were really about Dr. Frankenstein and some of his crazy creations. Rasputin was another
Rasputin, the Mad Monk, history's man of mystery.
And really, I mean, if you think about Rasputin in cinema history, Lee's role as Rasputin, he kind of owned that role as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lionel Barrymore, I think, had played him before, mm-hmm. but I think it's Chris Lee's were mostly known for. I think Tom Baker played him in Nicholas Alexander. Yeah. But I remember when Hammer liked to do a lot of double features, mm-hmm. they came out. I think it was Rasputin was paired off with the Reptile, was it? The thing is, you got like a little freebie when you went to the and I think with that you got a Rasputin beard.
Yeah. And I think Dracula, Prince of Darkness, was in those double features too, and they give you Dracula eyes or something.
Fangs or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, but that was Rasputin the Mad Monk. And in both of those, and Curse of Frankenstein and Horror Dracula were all directed by Terence Fisher. And Rasputin co-starred Barbara Shelley, who was Christopher Lee's frequent co-star in a lot of those films.
She was.
Yeah. So, well, the Hammer players there for a while. Mm-hmm. Every other film was had her.
And she's still around. She's still living in England. I'd love for her to do some American conventions. And then of course, 1973, 1974, we had the two Musketeers films.
I love those. Oh, yes. My favorite, bar none. They were shot as one movie, then broken up into two. Richard Lester does a great job with it. But I'm telling you, Christopher Lee, his scenes with Faye Dunaway and Charlton Heston, both deliciously evil. Oh, those are great scenes. Mm-hmm. And when they did This Is Your Life, which is on YouTube, you can watch that full show. Charlton Heston, they shot like a satellite with Charlton Heston, giving, a tribute to Christopher Lee, which was really nice. But those two movies together are just, I mean, the cast, and it's just, you can just tell he's just licking his chops through every scene he's in.
And his sword fighting skills in that film are very impressive. He was a talented fencer. And he did a lot of sword fighting in a lot of films. There was a couple of pirate movies, Pirates of Blood River, that he did for Hammer. And all the way up to the Star Wars film, where he actually has a sword fight or a fight with a Yoda.
That's right.
And he was 80 years old, and he wanted to do his own lightsaber battling scenes. I think George Lucas wanted to put a stuntman in, and Christopher Lee insisted on doing those scenes himself at his age. He loved fencing, and I know people who are big fans of fencing love those Musketeer movies because they think they have some of the best fencing sequences.
Yeah, I think he did a film called Crimson Pirate with Burt Lancaster.
That's right. That was one of his early roles.
He worked with Gregory Peck and Horatio Unglore.
Believable.
But he plays such a great villain. He's one of the screen's greatest villains.
No doubt. Yeah, I think he is the screen's greatest villain.
Yeah, then they did sort of a sequel of those Musketeer films about a dozen years later, and he reprised his role in that.
Exactly.
Wasn't it called The Fourth Musketeer?
Or The Return? Was it
The
Return of the Musketeers.
The Return of the Musketeers.
With Kim Cattrall as one of the characters in it, and C. Thomas Howell joining up with the fun.
Well, there you go. He played the mummy. He only played the mummy one time, but even his characterization of the mummy was unique.
The mummy, the living dead, bringing terror and death across 4,000 years.
You had Karloff and Lon Chaney, who would act really slowly, and you kind of laugh at him and say, well, I can run away from this mummy, but not Karras the mummy in 1959 for Hammer. Holy cow, that mummy was scary. That mummy moved quickly. That mummy was strong.
He takes a sword or a poker to the chest and goes right out of his back. It's great.
It is. Yeah, the mummy. He only played the mummy the one time, but, that's one of the best mummy movies. And there are some scenes where you see Christopher Lee acting in some flashbacks to ancient Egypt, too. So he's not just in the mummy costume the whole film. But that's going down our list, we're kind of going from 10 to 1. You can guess what number 1 is. Count Dooku, he played in the Star Wars movies. The Star Wars movies from... the ones that were made, 10 to 15 years ago, which people were sort of reverential when they came out, but I think now everybody really hates those things. And when the new Star Wars movies come out next year, I think those are going to look even worse in retrospect. But they had Christopher Lee, and he was by far the coolest thing in those Star Wars movies.
That was the greatest casting news. When they said Christopher Lee was going to be in,
It's a great pity that our paths have never crossed before, Obi-Wan. Qui-Gon always spoke very highly of.
And it was kind of a tribute to his old friend there, because of course Peter Cushing was Grand Moff Tarkin.
That's right, in the first
the first Star Wars film, and here's another Hammer superstar joining Lucas.
Gotta love that. Also, one of my very favorite Christopher Lee movies was The Wicker Man.
Those children out there, they're jumping through the flames in the hope that the god of fire will make them fruitful. Really, you can hardly blame them.
1973, Edward Woodward and Robin Hardy directed that film. Amazing drama about virgin sacrifices, and it's set up as a murder mystery, but I watch it all the time. I just got it on Blu-ray, and every time I watch it, I'm amazed how much music is in the film. It's really kind of a musical.
Oh. Yeah. Does he do a dance in it? Christopher does. I guess does he sing a little bit in it?
Yeah. Or? Well, he doesn't sing so much, but he has some great lines. There is a lot of singing in it, not so much by him.
Now there's a movie I know of that he does do singing in. It's The Return of Captain Invincible. Opposite Alan Arkin.
I don't think it made our top 10 list.
No, it shouldn't.
But they remade The Wicker Man with
Nicolas Cage.
I think Ellen Burstyn played Lord Summer Isle. They made her character a female. Everybody hates that movie. I don't think it's that bad.
Now, is this Wicker Man Chris's favorite film?
I think so. Yeah, he praised that film. It is a remarkable film, and it's a movie that's aged really well. It's sort of ahead of its time. Another character he played was Fu Manchu. I mean, he played Fu Manchu 5 times.
Christopher Lee as the merciless Dr. Fu Manchu, who cast a black shadow of fear across innocent lives.
And he plays sort of a proto-Fu Manchu in Terror of the Tongs.
That's right.
An early Hammer film. You know, but the Fu Manchus are all in color. They're all set in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And produced by a fellow named Harry Allen Towns?
Yeah, Harry Towers, yeah.
Towers.
You know, and Christopher Lee was 6 foot five, a 6 foot five Brit playing, this wizened Chinaman. But that's okay. They taped his eyebrows up a little bit to make his eyes slanty. The Fu Manchu movies aren't great. I've seen them all over the years. Vengeance of Fu Manchu was the first, and that was directed by Don Sharp, who did some work for Hammer, and that was a pretty good one. Face of Fu Manchu. But then the last two were actually directed by Joss Franco, Blood of Fu Manchu and Castle of Fu Manchu, and those are pretty lame. Although, Christopher Lee doesn't disappoint. He's really good in those.
Yeah, and each one of them has like a different actor playing Sir Nalen Smith.
Yeah.
So it's what
Nigel Green, I believe, played him in one.
There are a few film series where they change heroes, but the villain is always the same actor.
Yeah.
So. But no, they're very entertaining. They're nice Saturday matinee type of things to watch on a rainy afternoon. You know.
Yeah. Sorrow Man. He worked for Peter Jackson, I guess, in six. Six films for Peter Jackson as Sorrow Man.
A new power is rising. Its victory is at hand.
Yeah, I remember from one of the recent Hobbit films, you hear the voice before you see him, and and everybody in the theater at the screening went to is like, Christopher Lee is in this! Yeah. We were all excited for this 90-year-old actor, but that's how much he's loved, you know?
When he passed away, Peter Jackson posted on his Facebook page a really nice picture of the two of them together with Christopher Lee in character. And just a really nice heartfelt tribute too. Mm-hmm. So if you have a chance and you're on Facebook, go have a look at Peter Jackson's official page. It's a very nice, he concludes it with an icon of cinema has passed into legend.
Mm-hmm.
It's very sweet.
Yeah. Now, of course, the Hobbit films are prequels to the Lord of the Rings films. And Christopher Lee's character, Saruman, dies in the final. In the theatrical version, they cut out his death scene. You never saw him die until it came out on DVD with the extended cut, and then it's a pretty spectacular death scene. I don't know why they did that. That was kind of a major character. I guess they needed to cut it down to 3 hours. Good for Peter Jackson for casting Christopher Lee. He was so great. And like I said earlier, Tim Burton loved Christopher Lee, and you talked about his voice. He was the voice of the dragon in Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, that's right.
Everybody recognized him. He also played Willy Wonka's dad in the flashbacks of Charlie the Chocolate Factory. He was in
Corpse Bride. He was a voice in that.
Yeah. And Sleepy Hollow. And Dark Shadows.
He was a sailor in Dark Shadows.
Yeah.
Just incredible career.
Yeah, no doubt. And one of my favorites, it was, and we mentioned this, his villain Scaramanga in the 1974 007 film The Man with the Golden Gun, which, here's a piece of trivia, that's the only James Bond movie where Bond only kills one person. throughout the entire film, and that of, well, I don't want to give it away, but everybody's seen it. He kills Scaramanga at the very end. And, of course, you have Hervé Villechaize as Nick Knack, his little midget assistant.
Perfect.
Yeah, yeah, but in most of the Bond films, you know, the villain has a lot of henchmen, like, you know, Goldfinger has odd jobs. Hervé Villechaize isn't really his henchman. He's like his assistant.
Yeah.
But the real threat is Scaramanga himself.
Right.
And as I recall, Chris, it was the step-cousin of Ian Fleming.
That's right. That's right. In fact, Ian Fleming wanted Christopher Lee to play Dr. No in 1961. So, yeah, Scaramanga and one of my favorite, probably my favorite, Roger Moore. Bond.
Yeah.
Because of Lee.
Yeah, it didn't do that well at the box office, but I think in retrospect, but mostly because of Christopher Lee, it's gotten a lot of a lot of credit there. A lot of the more Bonds are silly, like Moonraker is silly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think as the years go by, we appreciate Chris Lee as the villain.
He's got such charisma, and he's one of the sexiest Bond villains. I mean, bar none. If you can come up with another one, have at it. But Christopher Lee and the white,
Yeah. Handsome. Well, they're always very dapper.
Yeah, and then, of course, his greatest role, which he will be best remembered for, is Dracula.
Yeah.
He played Dracula 7 times for Hammer Studios, and 4 or 5 times outside of that. The first time was the 1958's Horror of Dracula.
Mr. Harker, I'm glad that you've arrived safely. I am Dracula, and I welcome you to my house.
Some people consider that the best of the 7 films he made for as Dracula for Hammer. It's not really my favorite.
I think it's mine. I have a fond remembrance of seeing it for the first time when I was a kid, when I was homesick from school, and it was better than any medicine that on the market. I felt 100% better after watching that morning.
Yeah, it is great. It's way up there. I like Hammer Glamour.
Oh yeah,
and I think Melissa Stribling was Mina in that, and she kind of was a nothing actress. Some of the other
Valerie Gaunt.
Yeah, you had Barbara Shelley in the second one. You had Carolyn Monroe in one. Who else? Stephanie Beecham was
Veronica
in one.
Carlson.
Yeah, Veronica Carlson. Linda Hayden. You know, all the other Dracula movies I can name an actress. Jenny Hargraves. I can name an actress that I really liked.
Joanna Lumley.
Yeah, there was another Hammer films and Horror of Dracula. I can't really say that, but it is really great. It sort of set the groundwork for all the other Hammers.
It's got Peter Cushing as Van Helsing, which is just wonderful.
The battle at the end of it is just
a classic. Yeah. You know?
And then he made, I guess, 4 without Cushing, and then Cushing came back in the 70s for Dracula 80, 72, and Satanic Rites of Dracula, which they're all interesting in their own ways.
Of course, we were talking about the pseudo Dracula he plays in Magic Christian.
Mm-hmm.
He just does he have any lines at all?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Well, I think he has a whip too, doesn't he? Isn't he whipping people on a ship?
I don't recall, but of course, he doesn't have any dialogue in Dracula: Prince of Darkness either.
No, he didn't have a lot of dialogue in any of those Dracula films. It was just his presence.
Yeah, and like I say, you talked about him being attractive. You know, Barbara Shelley really digs him.
Yeah. Well, in 1970, he started a movie for Jess Franco called Count Dracula, which was very faithful to Bram Stoker's novel. It's sort of a poorly paced film, but it's interesting because he does have a lot of dialogue in that.
Listen to them, the children of the night. What music they make.
And he's wearing a mustache and gray temples, and they try to make him look like the way Dracula was described in the novel. And Klaus Kinski plays Renfield in that one. So
is Herbert Lahm Van Helsing?
Yeah, Herbert Lahm is Van Helsing in that one,
Another Hammer veteran
who's
a fan of the opera.
That's right.
Next Monday, TCM is having a full day of Christopher Lee films.
Good.
Should have been a full weekend, by gosh.
It could have
been a full month, doggone it. He was in 280 movies.
It runs from 6:15 a.m. In the morning till 6 p.m. at night. They could have gone much. Yeah. There were a lot of films like Airport 77. Where's that? One of my personal favorites.
Mm-hmm. But The Mummy, Curse of Frankenstein, Horror of Dracula, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, Dracula Rises from the Grave, Horror Express, which was a film he made in Spain with Peter Cushing, which interesting film, and The Three Musketeers and The Four Musketeers.
Not a bad list there. I might have thrown in the Bond film. I might have thrown in one of the Lord of the Rings films. But you say if they do a full month-long celebration in October, put those in there.
Yes.
But at least it's being done during the day, too, because a lot of times their tributes are done overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is smack dab in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
So get your DVR cleaned out because
make some space.
Make some space.
So rest in peace, Christopher Lee. I think he was probably my favorite. You know, next to Clint Eastwood, I think he was probably my favorite living actor. He was married to his wife, Git, for 54 years.
Did you ever get to see him in person?
I didn't. He did a couple of conventions. I know he did the FanX convention in Baltimore. I know he was very strict about only signing his autobiography, which was entitled Tall, Dark, and Gruesome, a great name for his autobiography. He did a couple of conventions, but, you know, he just kept working and working. He didn't have time to do that kind of stuff. But he was always very generous to his fans.
Well, I'm one up on you because I got to see him when he was in Chicago about 14 years ago, 15 years ago. He was one of the judges at the Chicago International Film Festival, and they did a special night.
Oh, wow.
They did a Q&A with him at the Music Box Theater. I think you've been there before there on Southport and Addison. At the Music Box Theater, he did a Q&A, and then they played Horror of Dracula.
Wow.
And just to hear that booming voice going out through the auditorium was just fantastic.
Was he at the screening then? Did he speak a little before the screening?
Well, he spoke. They did well, he was interviewed by, I forget the interviewer, but he spoke a little bit before, and he had a couple of nice stories about Peter Cushing, and couldn't have been more charming. He even told a story about checking into the hotel in Chicago, and when he's registering, the guy says, you've got an interesting voice. You ever thought about going into acting?
Did he and Vincent Price have the same birthdays? Have I read that? Different years, but the same birthday?
Yeah, May 27th, yeah.
And then Cushing a couple of days before,
right?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing. Love of course, one of the last things I saw Chris do was a Christmas greeting wearing the hat that
Vincent
Price
gave. We posted that years ago.
Oh, that's just charming.
Yeah, yeah. So Christopher Lee, gone, but not forgotten. We love Christopher Lee. Cannon Films was a studio that was doing pretty well, and then around the early 80s, it was bought by a pair of Israel cousins named Yoram Globus and Menachem Golan.
Yeah. Now, as I understand, Menachem was actually a director. He directed The Apple, didn't he?
The Apple. Have you ever seen The Apple?
I've heard about The
Apple.
Yeah,
have you ever seen The Apple?
It's strange.
I just watched the trailer. It's sort of it looks like a cross between Rocky Horror Picture Show and Can't Stop the Music. It's like a disco musical that takes place in the future, and they're worshiping this apple. And it stars Mary Catherine Stewart, who was in Night of the Comet,
yes.
And it looks like a blast. I think you can get it on DVD. I think it was unavailable for a long time, but now it's out there.
Kind of a cult film.
Yeah, kind of a very small cult, apparently, because I was sort of unfamiliar with it until fairly recently. But yeah, these guys, the Golden Globus, they called it, days of Cannon Studios. They made a lot of cheapo action films, musicals, sex films.
Yeah, they were quick to leap upon any sort of craze, as I recall. Yeah, I mean, they had the first sort of rapping films and the first breakdancing films.
Yeah, Breakin' and Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo, which is where this documentary gets its title from.
Even the Lambada, they did a movie about. The Forbidden Dance.
Lambada, the Forbidden Dance. And then there was a second Lambada movie, it was called Lambada Set the Night on Fire. But I think the Forbidden Dance, the thing Set the Night on Fire had Gregory Peck's son in it.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, this was around the same time, I guess, that New World was sort of its last legs, and New Line was still going strong.
Yeah.
And there's always been a tradition of these sort of maybe second-string movie studios there, but sometimes they would come out with stuff that was a lot more entertaining and had more passion than the major studios.
I love these films. I actually printed out a list of all the Cannon films from the 80s, and so many of these I saw at the theater. Charles Bronson, who everybody knows is my favorite actor of all time, he was a Cannon regular there, and a lot of, you know, starting with Death Wish 2 in 1982, he made five or six movies for Cannon, including Death Wish 3 and Messenger of Death and Kinjite Forbidden Subjects and Murphy's Law, which is a fantastic film. And then, of course, the other Chuck was Chuck Norris. Chuck Norris did Missing in Action for Cannon, which is a huge hit. They made a couple of sequels to that. Invasion USA, Hero in the Terror. These are all, and I saw all of these at the theater. I really never made the connection. Oh, these are all from the same studio, because there was a lot of studios. You mentioned New World, and there was Crown, and there was a lot of low budget studios that you would see movies at the theater back in the 80s.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that I read that they were kind of the go-go boys, as they were called, the heads of Cannon, really knew how to sell a movie. And a lot of times what they were selling didn't quite deliver on what the poster or what the commercial promise, but I don't know. I guess they filled the grindhouses before they got shut down, and a lot of drive-ins that
I saw
play.
A lot of these at the drive-in, but I saw a lot of them at the theaters, too. There was
the multiplex. Yeah,
well, even there was the Sunset Hills Cinema by my house, which is where the movie where I saw a lot of these things. Like I mentioned, the Chuck Norris. Then they had their own. Then they came up with their own action. You know, Norris and Bronson, of course, were already established action heroes before they started working for Cannon, but they came up with their own action hero. His name was Michael Dudikoff.
See the American Ninja?
Yeah, American Ninja.
Oh, yeah.
See, they were ripping off the martial arts, the
Avenging
Bruce Lee
Force.
Stuff.
Yeah, Michael Dudikoff. I don't know whatever happened to him. He always had this. There was a black actor named Steve James that was sort of his sidekick. you'd probably recognize Steve James. He was in Altman's The Player. He actually died at age 42.
Wasn't a lot of these after the Rambo craze?
Well, Mystic in Action was definitely a Rambo knockoff that did really.
Yeah, I understand that they either Golan or Globus actually credited James Cameron for Missing in Action 2, that they had somehow gotten a copy of the screenplay for Rambo, and so they kind of took elements of that, and he acknowledged that. Yeah. You know, so it's surprising.
But then they put their foot in the water with some art films. They came out with stuff like Fool for Love, which I believe was directed by Robert Altman, wasn't it?
Sam Shepard.
Runaway Train was actually up for an Oscar for Jim.
Yeah, Runaway Train's an interesting film. I love Runaway Train. That was actually based on a treatment by Kurosawa. Kurosawa was going to make that with Toshiro Mifune. That was supposed to be his first color film, and it fell through, and it sat on a shelf for a decade or two, and it was sold to the Cannon people as a project for Bronson. Bronson was supposed to play the John Voight role. They decided to put more money into it and put an Oscar winner in the lead role, and it was a big hit for Cannon, and it was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, including John Voight for actor, and Eric Roberts in his only Oscar-nominated performance.
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
And I just saw up here Grace Quigley, one of the last films of Katharine Hepburn and her co-star, and that is Nick Nolte. So, that's kind of interesting.
52 Pickup, you ever seen that?
John Roy Frankenhammer, Scheider. Right?
Yeah.
And the Hanoi Hilton?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, wasn't that Michael Moriarty?
Yeah.
Oh, and I'd forgotten that actually they got Stallone for a couple of films.
Yeah, Over the Top, the arm wrestling
was
classic.
Cobra there? So
Cobra.
Yes. And there's an interesting sort of superhero connection to the Cannon brothers, because I recall picking up Variety when I was in college, and they would have these lavish ads, like 7 or 8 pages, and every year they were promoting that the Spider-Man film was coming.
Yeah. Half of the movies never really came out.
No, that they were going to do Spider-Man for a while. Tobey Hooper was going to do it for a while. Albert Pyun, and they wrote a screenplay, even made some sets, but nothing ever really became of it. And I think that's maybe the reason that it took so long for them to work out the screen rights for Spider-Man, because I have a feeling that the Cannon guys were just selling the distribution rights to different countries everywhere that they could.
But they did make a infamous superhero movie. We were talking about this one a little last night. Superman 4, Quest for Peace.
Yes.
Which really killed that series, but it really killed any Superman movie for a couple of decades until the Brandon Routh thing came out.
I have a little more affection for that than Superman 3, the Richard Pryor Superman film. But I've read a couple of Superman history books over the last few weeks, and they talk about that, about how the Salkins wanted to generate some money. They'd gotten a deal with Warners, but they didn't want to sink the money into it, so they got a hold of Cannon.
Mm-hmm.
And Cannon severely slashed the budget on it. It went from $36 million to $17 million. That seemed a lot these days. They got Hackman back, and they had to make quite a few deals to get Christopher Reeve
They got Margot Kidder back.
For a cameo, basically, for it. Mariel Hemingway is more the female lead in it. But they Christopher Reeve had been wanting to do this movie that Cannon did produce called Street Smart, which I think might have gotten a nomination for Morgan Freeman.
Wasn't that his first Oscar nom?
His first film was a movie called Blade.
Okay.
But that was his first Oscar nom.
So I think Christopher had this idea, or someone had submitted it to him, about Superman getting rid of nuclear weapons, and that was he was wanting to push this message in it. So he also was the second unit director on Superman 4, The Quest for Peace.
But we can't talk about Superman 4 without talking about Mark Pillow as Nuclear Man.
Oh, the classic.
We've got this 80s hair, and He really kind of looks like He-Man. And don't they battle on another planet or something?
Now, of course, Cannon did do the He-Man movie, Masters of the Universe film.
And I think it was those two films that sort of, both of those films went lost a lot of money for Cannon.
Yeah.
And I think that was sort of the beginning of the end for Cannon Studios.
Yeah, they were actually going to do Masters of the Universe 2, and they you know, the Mattel wouldn't get them the rights, so they just turned it into Cyborg with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Wasn't the Masters of the Universe the live action? Not the animated
one. Right, it was
one.
Live action. Yeah,
with Dolph Lundgren. And Courtney Cox is in it, I believe.
And Chelsea.
Frank Langella, I believe, is in it.
Skeletor, yes.
Yeah, and what is Chelsea's last name? Because she married Scott Bakula.
Oh, yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Do you know Scott Bakula's parents live two doors down from me?
Oh, wow.
No, but his father just died.
But what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, yeah. And, well, they also were touting that they were going to do a Captain America film.
Yeah.
And turns out that once Golden Globus split, I think Yoram Globus started 21st Century Communications or Entertainment, he did produce a Captain America film in 1990 that never played theaters here in this country, went right to home video with Matt Salinger, J.D.'s son, as Captain America. And actually, it popped up on Channel 24 a couple of weeks ago. And
amazing.
It's terrible. Yeah. And I guess they had some German investors, so they made the Red Skull Italian.
Well, what's not terrible is Electric Boogaloo, the wild untold story of Cannon Film. That was, of course, a track from Titanic, the great score by James Horner. James Horner died about less than 2 weeks ago. He was just 61 years old. He died in a private plane crash. Sad. He was at the top of his game, one of the great film composers of all time. Michelle, tell us a little bit more about James Horner.
He was a prolific, for our age, he was this prolific Oscar-winning composer, you know, and I was so sad to hear of his death, and it first hit Twitter, and then it just expanded from there. I grew up listening to his scores. His scores and his themes for the films were so emotionally rich, and he gave each film such spirit. We all know him from Braveheart and Aliens. Mm-hmm. I mean, the list goes on. Star Trek II, Apollo 13, Wolfen, Legends of the Fall, but I grew up, I was introduced to his music in a movie that he and James Cameron worked on, Battle Beyond the Stars.
Yeah,
from 1980. Yeah. Lots of horns.
That was his first score.
Then he went on to do Krull. And
lot of action films.
And he and James Cameron both got their start with Roger Corman on Battle Beyond the Stars.
Everybody got their start with Roger Corman.
Exactly. Gail Ann Hurd. And, you know, that, like I said, that's when I first noticed Horner. And then the two of them went on to collaborate with Aliens, Titanic, and Avatar.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, he only won two Academy Awards for Titanic
both
and for
Titanic,
the song,
yeah.
You know, My Heart Goes On. So even though he received 8 additional Academy Award nominations, 5 additional Golden Globe nominations, and won 6 Grammy Awards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was first introduced to him via Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
That's an amazing score.
Pretty much wore out my 33 record of it.
Thank you.
And then I started, when the internet started and Pandora, I started hearing some cuts from Battle Beyond the Stars.
Yep.
And it's kind of a warm-up for Wrath of Khan.
It is. It's because he went Battle Beyond the Stars, then Krull, then Star Trek II, and they have these loud, you know, these booming loud horn sections with kind of that became his music, his instrument to go to. And I also like that he worked with Ron Howard on two movies. One of my favorites, Apollo 13. And and then A Beautiful Mind, which Beautiful Mind won Best Picture, but he did not win Best
Score. He also scored Ron Howard's Willow.
And Willow, exactly.
And thinking about his comic book.
And wait a minute, and The Grinch Who Stole Christmas.
Thank you.
Oh my goodness, I didn't realize that. But
and Ransom. more Ron Howard movies.
So Ron Howard and James Cameron were his go-to collaborators.
Exactly.
Mostly,
and The Missing.
And The Missing.
Ron Howard's movie. Wasn't that with Tommy Lee Jones?
Tommy Lee Jones. Yeah. I really, and Cate Blanchett, I believe.
That's right.
But, my favorite of his is Wrath of Khan, of course. But yeah, the Rocketeer is a great score.
Isn't it a great score?
Terrific movie in general, but his score, when the Rocketeer is finally taking flight, it's just spectacular. And it's interesting that James Horner himself, left to fly, and it's a tragic what happened. But you could kind of you could hear his love of flying in that score to Rocketeer. It's wonderful. And I had thought he had pretty much bowed out from scoring films after Avatar, but looking over, I guess his last film was Amazing Spider-Man, the very first.
Actually, his last film was Southpaw.
Yeah, he's got Southpaw coming out.
Oh, he has that coming out. Okay,
And you wonder if maybe it'll get an Oscar nom. There's going to be some emotion with the Academy, and maybe they'll give them an Oscar nom for that.
Yeah.
It depends how good the score is, of course.
But when back in 1986, when Aliens came out, and that score... I mean, for a few years afterwards... Every trailer that would come out would have the music from Aliens with it. If it was an action movie, boy, did that music, did that score make that film?
Got more play than Bad to the Bone, huh?
Exactly.
Oh.
Exactly. So, but no, they're saying his agent and publishers said Wolf Totem, The 33, and Southpaw are his last scores.
Hmm.
Wolf Totem, you say?
Yes.
And the 33?
The 33.
You have a feeling Southpaw's score will probably be one of those subtle ones. At least that's the thing I'm getting from the trailer. I doubt if it'll be one of his sweeping scores that we're most familiar with from like say Rocketeer and things like that and Avatar.
Mm-hmm. And the Hollywood Tribune had a tribute to Horner that was penned by James Cameron. It's on, part of it's on our site, and you can read the full thing at The Hollywood Reporter. And it's a beautiful tribute by Cameron to the composer.
So go out and buy some James Horner soundtrack CDs.
Or find it on YouTube.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I have the compilation at home. I think it's called Heart of the Ocean.
Oh, yeah.
That's got about 10 or 12 of his best scores. That's worth checking out or seeking out.
And Wolfen and 48 Hours.
Yeah.
Another, it was kind of in the 80s. He was very much into the marimbas during that time. Mm, sad to see him go.
Yeah,
very sad. And Braveheart and Apollo 13 were both released the same year, and they were both Best Picture. They both, and I believe he lost to El Postino.
That's right. But, so RIP, James Horner. A little bit about silent films. We don't really spend much time talking about silent films here at Weird Movie Geeks, the podcast. But last month they had Barnes & Noble had its annual sale on for the Criterion DVDs and Blu-rays, which are so awesome. They're always jam-packed with extras and always just superb transfers. But they're so darn expensive. I mean, if I had bottomless pockets, I would own all of them. But I don't, so I always save my money and I'll buy four or five in July. But one of the ones I bought last month was Safety Last, starring Harold Lloyd, 1923.
Oh, good one.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. It's the picture quality in this. It looks like it might have been shot just a year or two ago.
Yeah.
It's just so crisp and clean. I think a lot of folks might not be that familiar with Harold. They probably grew up watching or seeing that iconic photo of him. Hanging onto the arms of a clock.
That's probably the most iconic photo in all of the silent era.
Yeah, but his films weren't as easily available to people as
they were out of circulation.
Yeah, I read a biography of Harold, and he toyed with the idea of selling the rights to Safety Last and a couple of his other films to network television, but he was wanting something like $200,000 for one broadcast which was ridiculous back then.
But they weren't even in the Black Hawk catalogs back in the 50s and 60s. And I used to go to the library when I was 12, 13 years old, and I would check out Charlie Chaplin movies, and I would watch them on my Super 8 and 8mm projectors over and over. So I was pretty well steeped in Chaplin, and then Keaton I sort of discovered on VHS. But I had not seen Harold Lloyd films. You and I saw The Freshman about a year or so ago.
Yeah.
They played it at Webster University, a 35mm print with live music by an orchestra. And I was just blown away. I thought that was one of the very best silent comedies I had ever seen.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I didn't discover him until the mid-70s when I started going to college in Chicago. Every Friday night, the Art Institute was running Harold Lloyd films with a live musical accompaniment. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I never knew about this guy, and he's just fantastic.
Oh, and I had never seen Safety Last until I picked up this Criterion.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a glaring omission, but it's not anymore. And he plays the glasses. I think his name's actually Harold, but they refer to him as the boy.
Yeah, actually, in the film itself, he gets a pay packet from the department store he works at, and it says Harold Lloyd.
The stub says Harold Lloyd.
But
on
in The Freshman, he's Harold Lamb.
Okay,
so.
He gets a job at this big department store in Los Angeles, and he's trying to impress his girlfriend who lives in a different city.
South Bend.
Yeah, and he tells her that he's the manager when actually he's just kind of a lowly employee. So the first hour, I guess, or 45 minutes, is all this wacky comedy in the department store. You know, a movie it reminded me of, and this may sound stupid, but it reminded me of Who's Minding the Store? With Jerry Lewis, which was directed by Frank Cashlin, had sort of a similar, madcap visual style that would have been right at home in the silent area.
Oh, sure.
Era.
Sure. Well, I'm sure that Lloyd was an inspiration to Mr. Cashlin.
And that's Jerry Lewis, perhaps.
Oh, he was one of the 36 founding members of the Academy.
Oh, Harold Lloyd was?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had a heck of a career outside of films.
Look at his list on Internet Movie Database. He was in everything.
He made more movies than Chaplin and Keaton combined.
Yep.
He was very prolific. He made 12 silent features in the 1920s, and Chaplin only made 4.
Yeah, I think most of the silent features he made are still available. I know that a lot of his short subjects are lost, which is unfortunate.
Well, in the commentary, I think they mentioned that he had control of the negative, so he took really good care and was very protective of his films.
That's why they weren't all over TV. I think he wanted such a large amount of money to run them on TV because he just didn't want them on TV. He didn't want them interrupted by commercials or cut for time or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to keep them pure and, you know, seen in a theater, really.
You have so many great gags in Safety Last. And you mentioned the quality of Criterion's transfer. I mean, you can read windows in downtown Los Angeles.
Oh.
I mean, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. It's never looked better.
And then there's, of course, the famous last 20 minutes where he's in order to, I guess, bring publicity to this department store, the manager offers $1,000 reward to somebody who comes up with a gimmick to bring people in, and he has a friend who's known as the human fly who can climb buildings. And this guy was actually a real human fly, but the guy can't do it because he's being chased by this cop, so Harold Lloyd's Harold has to step in and climb this 12-story building.
His buddy says, I'll take over once you get to the second floor.
And of course, that never happens. And it's about a 20-minute sequence. It's just the most amazing thing. I think this is my favorite silent comedy of all time. And he's climbing floor to floor, and a mouse climbs up the leg of his pants.
Oh.
And there's a photo shoot involving a gun. Halfway up.
There's a plank that gets jutted out of a window, you know, and he has to dangle from that. And
it goes on and on.
And they talk about when it was first released and people were actually fainting in the theaters at this thing.
Well, it looks like he's climbing up this building, and there's no double exposure, but apparently they explain it in the commentary. They put, I guess, a couple of stories on top of another building, so if he fell, he wouldn't fall off, 12 stories.
He would hopefully hit the mattress. Hopefully!
But didn't they say they threw a dummy just to see what would happen, and the dummy, fell 20 stories?
Bounced right off that mattress.
It's
interesting. They in one of the bonus features on it, and the bonus features on Criterion stuff are is terrific. Mm-hmm. They use some animation techniques to try to recreate how they think they shot the film, because there are no on-set photos from there, from that time period. Yeah. And, they think they used three different buildings and built up facades, like little two-story fake buildings on top of the roofs of these buildings. And it's really incredible. And boy, does it work.
It does. And let's talk about the very last shot. He gets up on the roof and he grabs the girl by the arm, and there's a tar patch on the roof. So he takes four steps through the tar patch. First step is left shoe comes off. The second step is right shoe comes off. The third step is left sock comes off. And the fourth step is right sock comes off. And then it fades to black, and that's the end of the film.
That's perfect.
It's so brilliant. And you would never see Adam Sandler or Melissa McCarthy or Will Ferrell or all the great comedy stars of today pulling off anything resembling that. Even The Artist, which won the Best Picture 3 or 4 years ago, won the Oscar. That was an homage to the silent films. Mm-hmm. And they did a lot of silent film type gags. But there is more gags and 10 minutes of safety less than there were in the entire The Artist.
It's so... Even, but the stuff before the buildings, I'm glad you talked about that. The stuff in the department store is really clever. And the fellas mention on all the terrific commentary tracks on there. It's Leonard Maltin and a fellow named Carell, who was a Harold Lloyd historian. Mm-hmm. I forget the gentleman's first name.
Harold Lloyd. Yeah, interviewed him.
And there's photos of him helping Harold, looking at the old films and negatives and all that.
Lloyd didn't die until the early 70s.
But he talks about how well some of the gags play with modern audiences, and there's a sequence in which the guys have to hide from their landlady that I remember when I first saw it, just got screams of laughter.
So we highly recommend going out, even if it's not on sale anymore, going out and buying the Criterion version of Safety Last.
And if you like that, get the Freshman.
Yeah, definitely.
Because that's on Criterion also.
That is. I'm going to have to break down and buy that one. David Bowie, who died of age 69 of cancer. He made some interesting movie choices, David Bowie. He didn't really make any bad movies. I was looking at a list of the movies he was in. I mean, I guess he didn't need to. He probably didn't need the work. He was more successful as a musician, of course, than as an actor. But if you look at his body of work in movies, really interesting choices, one after another. Starting with, I guess, The Man Who Fell to Earth, Nicholas Roeg's bizarre three-hour film about a Martian. What else was he in? The Hunger?
The cool elegance of David Bowie. The open sensuality of Susan Sarandon. Combined to create a modern classic of perverse fear.
Hunger's a little cheesy, but it's still a pretty visually interesting movie that Tony Scott, I believe, directed.
One of my personal favorites, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
Yeah.
Go back if you can watch. Go back and watch that.
Yeah,
and Basquiat, where he played Andy Warhol. That was fun. Yeah, and he had a great cameo in the first Zoolander.
And of course, a really
great Nikola Tesla.
And
The Prestige.
I like that casting. Good for Chris Nolan to put him in that.
And Pontius Pilate, Scorsese had him as Pontius Pilate in his Last
Jim
Temptation
Henson
of
movie.
Christ.
Oh, Labyrinth. The Goblin. Oh.
A world where anything seems possible and nothing is what it seems.
Everything I've done for you. I move the stars with no one.
We're actually showing that at Tenacious Eats Movies for Foodies in March.
Had you already scheduled it?
No. This was Chef Liz wanted to show it a couple of years ago, and tickets. Nobody bought any tickets. She only sold like a half a dozen tickets, so she ended up canceling because of low ticket sales. But she thinks, with Bowie being in the news and dying,
Labyrinth is a good one because young girls, teenagers at the time, there's a few scenes that. And then, the girls were gushing over David Bowie in that role.
And Jennifer Connelly is in that, too, speaking of teenage girls.
Oh, yeah.
What else was Bowie in?
There was a nice piece by Christopher Nolan in Entertainment Weekly about working with Bowie. You should check that out.
Yeah, very nice. Good, yeah.
Yeah, what was Just a Gigolo?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who was it? Was Marlene Dietrich his co-star?
I think so, yeah.
And David Bowie's son, we talked about this last week, is filmmaker Duncan Jones who did Moon.
And Warcraft coming up is Duncan Jones.
Yes, it is. And he did put on a nice picture on Twitter of he and his dad when he was little. So it was and we had posted that on our
I saw a trailer for Warcraft. Did you see that trailer?
Yeah, we've had that.
Special effects look really cheesy.
And do we mention that his album is now number one?
There you go.
Yeah,
there you go.
Amazing. Yeah,
that's not surprising.
And you know, his film work was really interesting, and he didn't give a performance that I didn't like, but you know, his work in across music and culture and even fashion, you know, it's a shame that people are talking about him now that he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't have that top-selling film.
Yeah. So R.I.P.
Top-selling album.
So R.I.P. to David Bowie.